I'll call to order the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is Monday, February 10th, a wintry day, and I really appreciate those who were able to make it in. And with having such limited time constraints with the special session, we felt it was important to get through the work that we could, because Wednesday could well be our last day, and we wanted to make sure that we could hear some concerns as well as support for this bill and potentially move it on Wednesday. We do not have any of the paperwork to move either of these bills now, but the chair's intention is to move these bills on Wednesday. What else? We wanted to give special kudos to Senator Montes Anderson's staff person, George Stewart, for getting Lori here. Lori, would you like to comment on what a great job you did?
Well, I live in Gresham, and I had frozen pipes. I had a frozen driveway, and everything was frozen in the front of my house. And so he drove in his big, heavy-duty truck from Scappoose. You'd think I'd be able to find someone from my own district and help me get out, and I really appreciate that.
Well done. George, you made a quorum possible today. We appreciate that. All right, so why don't we just go ahead and jump right into it. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1522. Shannon, could you tee it up for us?
Certainly, Chair Shields, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1522 is one of your committee measures. This one, with exception, prohibits the use of motor vehicle registration surveillance cameras. You have four amendments to consider. The first, the proposed -1 amendments, clarify the use of these cameras as relates to the Department of Transportation for traffic research, toll collection, and motor carrier enforcement actions. The -2s, -3s, and -4 all change the length of time that data can be held by a law enforcement agency and the retention period. The -2 allow law enforcement agencies to retain captured data, all captured data, for 21 days with a 180-day retention period for data under a court order with additional 180-day extensions. The -3s change that to 90 days and 180 days, and the -4s change it to a straight 180-day of capture.
Thank you, Jenna. Let's bring up Becky Strauss.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Becky Strauss. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon, and we are here in support of this bill. I want to make a couple notes before I start my testimony. I don't believe it's in OLIS yet, but there are two additional support letters, one from Representative Jennifer Williamson. She testified in support of the bill during January legislative days and has submitted written testimony to the record now during session. The other letter of support is from the Center from Intercultural Organizing, an organization up in Portland that is in support of the bill because they see it as a good government bill and a good privacy bill, and emphasizing it specifically that the lack of privacy protections has particular and unique harm on the communities that they serve, diverse communities of many culturally specific origin. And when we look at lack of privacy protection in government surveillance, there is a there's a unique harm to those communities because of the risk or the heightened risk of discriminatory targeting. And so that group has submitted a letter of support for Senate Bill 1522. I will also have submitted written testimony, and so I won't read that. It looks very similar to the testimony that we delivered in January, but I do want to hit on a few key points, and then I'll just walk through the bill and the amendments, and then we can have any discussion or answer any questions that you might be interested in doing. So, as I said, this testimony does look very similar to the testimony that we delivered in January. It talks a lot about what this license plate reader technology does, and if you have any questions about that, please feel free. For the interest of time, I'm not going to review that again because I think that we talked about that already. So please correct me if you would like some more information about that. But I think one important piece to note about the technology is I see it breaking out in basically two two core functions for law enforcement, particularly, and there are other public agencies that use these, but focusing on law enforcement, there seem to be two core functions. One is the real-time benefit to using the technology. These cameras are capturing license plates at thousands of plates per second. And so in a real-time moment, they're able to match against several other databases, for example, a stolen car database or LEDS, the criminal warrants database, to see if there's a car of interest that's hitting the law enforcement officer's radar at the time. In real time, these plates are generating, the cameras that are generating hits and non-hits. You have a hit if it's matching up against a database. We know that this is a stolen car, for example. And then non-hit would be any plate that goes through that isn't rising to the level of a criminal or really even parking violation interest. The second function is more of a historical value. As these cameras collect and aggregate and store and sometimes share the data, it may become beneficial, and we've heard from law enforcement officers that it has become beneficial to look at that data from a historical lens and say, we have this travel pattern of someone that has suddenly become a person of interest, or we have the need to identify who was in a place and time in real time that wasn't a person of interest. So there's kind of these two dual values to the cameras, and the ACLU certainly does not take the position that the advancement of surveillance technology is inherently bad. We want law enforcement agencies and public bodies more broadly to have the tools they need to do their job. What we'd like to see is that privacy principles and protection of constitutional rights stay in step with that advancement. And so that's the purpose of this bill, is to put in some very reasonable, clear guidelines that also allows for transparency over what our law enforcement agencies are doing. So a couple key points, and then I'll walk through the bill. The first is that these license plate readers are collecting data without suspicion, and that's a very important distinction, a very important point to make when we talk about constitutional principles. The value of privacy within our Constitution is that people are free from government intrusion without some sort of warranted invasion of privacy. But instead, what these cameras are doing are aggregating and collecting people's innocent data without suspicion that they've done anything wrong. Just by nature of driving around town, your license plate is being captured by these cameras, kept and stored and possibly shared. And that's really kind of turns the principles on its head. This is really a collect-it-all approach. And what we've seen, especially recently this summer with the NSA revelations and all the renewed discussion of privacy, is that this collect-it-all approach, in case we might need data later, it shocks people, it outrages people, and it really goes against good government and protection of our Constitution. The second point I want to make is that we do believe that there's an urgency in moving this bill this session. There's been some discussion about waiting until 2015. Certainly that's a choice of this committee and this legislature to do so. We would ask and urge that you do not. We mentioned in January that we did a public records request back in 2012 of law enforcement agencies in Oregon to find out where this technology is and how it's been used. We found that at that time, a handful of agencies were using this technology now. And so we're now in a place where license plate reader cameras are being used. They're being used without limit, except for the possibility that some of these law enforcement agencies have policies of their own. And as you see in my written testimony, those policies are kind of all over the map in terms of privacy protections or strength of those privacy protections. And so we do see an urgency to putting in place some clear guidelines to give us a roadmap going forward about how we use this technology safely and in a privacy-protective way. I'm going to go ahead and walk through the bill, and then I'll walk through the dash 1 and the dash 2, because the dash 3 and 4 are very similar, and I'll note the differences with the dash 3 and the dash 4. The dash 1 I'll go through the bill first. We talked about in January how we're beginning to attempt to look at data collection, government surveillance, privacy issues in the lens of a consistent privacy roadmap. And we talked a little bit about some of the consistent questions, whether we're talking about health records, student records, government surveillance, whatever type of data collection. We are asking legislators to look at this and ask some key questions. What are the usage restrictions? What are the retention requirements of the data collection? With whom can the data be shared? What kind of transparency elements are available to the public to know what's going on, and what kind of accountability measures are in place to ensure that they're being followed? And that's all outlined in my testimony. And to talk about the bill, I'll pull out a few of those elements of the privacy roadmap. So Senate Bill 1522 talks about usage of surveillance cameras, and Chana is correct. The bill starts with the default presumption that license plate readers cameras will not be used by public agencies in Oregon, and then it starts to enumerate the exceptions, and we believe they're fair, reasonable, and broad exceptions to that prohibition. So when you start with the presumption that the cameras may not be used, and then Section 2 lists out how they can be used. The first point is that the Department of Transportation may use the surveillance technology for regulating motor carriers and collecting tolls. I'll note that the Dash 1 amendment also adds research and analysis on traffic patterns to that list of uses for ODOT. The bill in Section 2 lists the ways that law enforcement may use the technology, and it lists several things related to enforcing parking and traffic violations and also investigating crimes. And then it further lists the specific databases that the cameras can be matched against when law enforcement is using them, or really when any public body is using them to carry out their authorized function. And those databases are ODOT databases, National Crime Information Center database of the Federal Department of Justice, local law enforcement data system, and our Dash 2 Amendment 2, 3, and 4 allow for expand that LEDS system to include an out-of-state equivalent, so Oregon's criminal justice database and then also Washington's, for example, can be a list of the databases that real-time law enforcement agencies are matching plate data against. And finally, state and federal missing persons lists. Section 3 talks about sharing, authorization for sharing the data once it's collected. Public bodies may share with other public bodies as long as all parties comply with the requirements set out in the bill. So, for example, Clackamas County may want information from license plate readers that are used by the Portland police, and that sharing is authorized by the bill so long as both of those agencies are subject to the same retention requirements, whatever they end up being, as we're continuing to debate that number. Public bodies may obtain data collected by private entities with a warrant. Anecdotally, sort of am aware that private entities are using these cameras for all sorts of things like traffic consulting, traffic management consulting, and the like. And those agencies are collecting data as well. Public bodies may access that data with a probable cause warrant. And finally, the records are exempt from public record except for a driver's own records. So that is a little bit of the push and pull about protecting the privacy of people whose plates are captured, and then also allowing for an individual to know what information the government has been collecting and storing about them. And that provision in Section 6 of the bill is how we've reconciled those dual interests. Section 3 also deals with the retention provisions around how long the data is kept once it's captured. Right now, the bill as written says that all data collected by law enforcement agencies may be kept for up to 14 days. After 14 days, the process for retention would break out into two categories, hit data and non-hit data. So we've talked about hit data is when you get a hit from a database that you're matching up against, indicating that this is a car or a plate or a vehicle of interest. That's your hit data. And that has no limits on the retention of the data, except for kind of on the back end, the even hit data must be destroyed once it's no longer needed for that criminal purpose. That's much longer than 14 days in many instances. The non-hit data after 14 days must be destroyed unless law enforcement goes to the court and asks for an extension. So that's where Channa was talking about the 180-day court order. In the bill as drafted, that's a 30-day court order, so that let me say this more clearly. If you have a 14-day retention period on innocent people's data, and law enforcement finds that data may be needed later, they would like to hold on to it because they have a particular reason for whatever criminal investigation purpose that they need it, they'd like to keep it longer than that 14 days. Law enforcement can go to the court and say, we have a reasonable suspicion that this data is relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation, and the court can then decide to grant a court order to extend beyond that 14 days. In the bill as drafted, those court orders are limited to 30-day increments. We'll see in the Dash 2, 3, and 4 amendments that we've extended out that 30 days to 180 days and actually put in an additional safety valve, if you will, exception on that 180-day court order if there's an additional showing of exceptional circumstances, for example, a cold case or a kidnapping that's taking a very long time to solve. A law enforcement agency could say to the court, 180-day renewals or 180-day renewals is too burdensome in this particular instance, and so we'd like to keep the data even longer. And that's available through the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments. Finally, in the bill as drafted, we've put in some attempts to address transparency and accountability in Section 4 to say that agencies using this surveillance technology must write and post on their website the policies that they use to govern the use of the technology and must post those reports annually on how they are using them. I've talked mostly about the amendments, but I'll go through whatever I've missed. The Dash 1 amendment is the product of discussions that we engaged in with the Department of Transportation, and I think that we have addressed their concerns, but I'll have Amy Joyce come up and present their position if she chooses to do that. I discussed that, well, so the two things that the Dash 1 does is it adds traffic research and analysis to the list of uses that ODOT can use the surveillance technology for. We had already listed tollway operations and motor carrier enforcement in those exceptions for ODOT. In regard to the traffic research and analysis, the requirement to be allowed to use the cameras for that purpose is that the data collected must be de-identified so that it cannot be associated with an individual driver, and it's our understanding that that will not impede the research and analysis of the traffic patterns. The second thing that the Dash 1 amendment does is it adds the term tollway operator to the list of uses. The original bill talks about ODOT using the cameras for tollway enforcement. We put that in as a safeguard so that should Oregon venture into the area of electronic tolling, that they could feel as if contracting with a private entity is not prohibited by this bill, and that's certainly the intention. So we added tollway operator as a phrase there. The Dash 2, 3, and 4 amendments are very similar, and I'll point out the differences, but I'll just sort of go through the Dash 2. The Dash 2 amends the prohibition on the use of cameras that might capture photos of individuals. There is a provision in the original bill that says law enforcement agencies cannot use cameras that might also capture the picture of a driver, for example, the face of a driver or something like that. Based on concerns from law enforcement that would mean they might have to replace their cameras or change their technology or be in violation of this law, we've changed that provision to say the cameras can take photos of individuals if that's what the technology does, but those images cannot be used for anything by law enforcement, and we think that's a reasonable compromise. The Dash 2 also expands the list of databases which the data can be matched against to include out-of-state criminal justice databases. I mentioned that in my earlier summary to say that Oregon has the LEAD system, the law enforcement data criminal justice, that doesn't spell LEADs, but to allow out-of-state databases to be matched as well, sort of the LEADs equivalent. The Dash 2 as well extends the time period for the retention of non-HIT data from 14 days to 21 days. And that's the key difference between the Dash 2, 3, and 4 amendments. The Dash 2 amendment is extending the retention period to 21 days, the Dash 3 to 90 days, and the Dash 4 to 180 days. The ACLU certainly submits to you that 21 days is more than appropriate. We support the Dash 2. I think some of this discussion will come down to a policy decision from this committee about which direction to go in terms of the date of data retention. The Dash 2 further, as Chana mentioned, as I've discussed, extends the time period for the court orders. The original bill says the court orders will be issued in 30-day increments. The Dash 2 extends that out to 180-day increments. And this, again, this is a compromise based on feedback that we've received from law enforcement interests that 30 days is too burdensome to continue to return to the court if the data is still relevant. And so we've extended that out and also listed the provision about exceptional circumstances that I mentioned that might extend that 180 days out in for the court order even further. The Dash 2 also clarifies, it's just a safeguard. I don't think that it substantively changes the bill, but the Dash 2 clarifies that data retention restrictions apply to captured plate data and also to any backup or copies of the data. As I start to learn more about this technology, my understanding is that in some places data collect is stored, for example, out on the cloud. This provision is meant to guard against the information in the cloud getting away from us, even as law enforcement agencies are complying with the retention requirements. Finally, the Dash 2 changes the limitations on retention of HIT data so that you have, as I mentioned, the 14-day or whatever your data retention requirement day limit is. Those 14 days apply to the innocent people's data, the non-HIT data. Your HIT data can be kept longer. And so this amendment changes the wording of how long the HIT data can be kept. Right now, the bill talks about the conclusion of a criminal proceeding. We thought that that was too short because the data might be needed for evidence in a trial or something like that. So we've changed that language from conclusion of a criminal proceeding to resolution of criminal charges so that it allows the data to be kept throughout the pendency of a trial, appellate proceedings, whatever it may be. The only substantive differences from what I've listed as the Dash 2 and the 3s and 4s are, one, the front-end retention period. So Dash 2 is 21 days, Dash 3, 90 days, Dash 4, 180 days. And the second difference is that for the Dash 4, where the original retention period is 180 days, that amendment does not include an exceptional circumstances provision. We believe that if you have 180 days on the front end and 180 days with a court order, it's not very burdensome for a law enforcement agent to go back 180 days later and ask for a renewal of the court order. So that Dash 4 doesn't have the exceptional circumstance escape valve. We really appreciate the work of Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and the stakeholders that have been engaging in the discussion with us, and we do hope to continue that discussion, but request, strongly urge you to move the bill forward on Wednesday with the Dash 1 and the Dash 2. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Senator Baird Sugar. Senator Morton Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you're going to need to help me with this because I trust my my police department, but then I've grown up in Gresham. I have a small police department, and I'm not with Portland. But it seems like we aren't trusting our law enforcement to use this data appropriately and putting a lot of hoops for them to go through, and I just need to be convinced that we can't trust our law enforcement, and therefore we need to have this legislation.
Thank you, Senator Mona Sanderson, for the question. Chair Shields, members of the committee, I think there's two things there. One, it's my belief that we have crafted the bill to allow for law enforcement to use these tools to the greatest extent that the Constitution allows them to, and that the idea that we're putting forth these guidelines is so that we can move forward in a way that this bill is not an obstacle to their use. But there's also I don't believe it's a competing interest. I believe that it's a parallel interest, and that's the vitality of civil liberties and the vitality of privacy protections. And if those aren't in place, and if the public doesn't believe that they're in place, the public will lose faith in our public safety system, will lose trust in our officers, and that's to the detriment of everyone. That's to the detriment of all of our public safety. I think that further, the second thing I would mention is that while we're not submitting that we all should not trust our public safety officers, it certainly makes the ACLU uncomfortable moving forward with legislation or not moving forward with legislation under the assumption that we should, kind of this just trust us approach. We don't operate under the collect it all in case innocent people might be guilty later. That's just a fundamental piece of our Constitution. We operate under the innocent until proven guilty system. And so this is a way to navigate both of those things. It's a way to make sure that the tools are used in the way that they're needed for law enforcement and that they're also keeping the privacy of Oregonians safe. One step further, I think that there is it deserves recognition that there is a fundamental independent value to privacy, to the core functioning of the General Government Committee, to the good government of functioning of our democracy. If the members of the public, first of all, are not aware of the type of surveillance that our government is engaging upon us, they will lose trust in the government, and they will begin to feel that they are always being monitored because they don't know otherwise. And they will not trust what their government is doing, and they will do things like chill their freedom of expression, chill their freedom of association, feel that their Fourth Amendment rights against unwarranted search and seizure are in violation. These are core things that deserve protection, because without them, we as Oregonians, we are as Americans, are not free to stretch the bounds of our civil liberties and stretch the bounds of who we are as individuals. And that's really at the core of what we're doing here, albeit a piecemeal approach, technology by technology.
Senator Birdsugar.
Thank you. Kind of to springboard off of what Senator Moons Anderson said, because of the new technology and the ability to gather just these unbelievable sources of data, that doesn't bother me. What bothers me is how we control those sources of data. And we don't have to look too far. All we have to do is look to Russia, what happened with the NSA. So it's not that I don't trust my law enforcement. I trust them very much. I don't trust the process of being able to protect all of this data. It's so easy anymore because of the technology for this data to be lost, given to the wrong person, sold for financial gain, or whatever. And so when you're starting to sell data that is collected on innocent people and lose control of that, I have a lot of trouble with that. So it's not that I don't trust law enforcement. I trust them very much. I trust with the process of how we retain this data and how it keeps slipping between our fingers someplace. So very concerned about that and appreciate your work.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. And I wanted to thank you, Becky, for working with all of the stakeholders on that, listening to their concerns with the co-sponsors of the bill. We had a long meeting regarding all these topics with Representative Williamson, Representative Huffman, Senator George, and myself. And I think the fact that you were willing to listen to their concerns, move to 21 days, move beyond the 30 days, that I think was a legitimate workforce issue. Sheriff said, look, we can't continually go back to court every 30 days. And the fact that you added a third escape valve, the exceptional circumstances, so that, and that was important to, particularly to my district attorney, for these kind of very, very important, complicated, long-running cases. So I think you've done a good job. We definitely want to hear from people who still have concerns, and but I thank you for your work on it.
Thank you, Senator.
Could we bring up Amy Joyce and Kevin Campbell, please? And then we've just got one other person signed up to testify on this bill. If there are others that want to testify, please let the committee administrator know. Amy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Start by thanking Becky Shields and the ACLU for talking to us early about the bill and learning about ways that the department currently uses license plate reader technology and aspires to use it in the future. So thanks for that, and came to the Dash 1 amendment, which really I think accommodates all of ODOT's needs. I passed out some written testimony, and it may be online by now.
The Dash 1 is the ODOT amendment.
So I won't read through that, but I'll just hit the highlights here. So ODOT currently is bringing online the use of this technology and the regulation of motor carriers, heavy trucks. This is an industry that is heavily, heavily regulated by both the federal and state government, and so ODOT uses this technology, for instance, bringing it online at the Woodburn Port of Entry. It's a sorting tool, basically. Instead of the waymaster there, looking at the license plate and writing it down and checking it against a database for safety and weight mile tax kinds of things, it just does it more quickly and more accurately. So that's how we're using it there. And also down by Junction City, kind of an unmanned way station, essentially. Going to bring that online here pretty soon. Sorts out any passenger-type vehicle, so that is even collected at the way station. Passenger vehicles don't even come into the way station, so they're not being captured there. So that's one way in which we're bringing that online now. We aspire to use it in the event of doing tolling. Open road tolling is the way of the future. Nobody's going to be stopping to pay an attendant or throw money in a basket. It's all going to be done by transponder, or if you don't have a transponder in your vehicle, license plate reader will capture that information and send you a bill so that you'll pay the toll. So in the event of tolling in Oregon, that's the direction likely it would go. And whether it's ODOT operating that or a licensed vendor or a vendor working with ODOT, that's how that would be used. Thirdly, our transportation planners, again, they're not using it currently, but aspire to do this very quickly, can use that data to look at very, very discrete data, where a vehicle enters the highway, where it exits the highway, how fast it's going, whether it's a heavy truck or a passenger vehicle. And all of this data can be used to make better decisions about planning long-term, but also in the short-term issues like detours, if there's a project or an incident, making the best decisions about that. So those are the three ways that ODOT either is using or aspires to use the technology. The Dash ones get us there. So we'd appreciate if you're going to move the bill, we're neutral on the bill, but that you would adopt the Dash 1 if you're going to do that.
Great. Thank you, Amy. Kevin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I'm here today to oppose Senate Bill 1522. I want to note up front, it's a difficult spot to be in when you're opposing the bill that's chief co-sponsors are the chief or the chair and the co-chair of the committee, and I'm sure that Senator George is watching, so I'll greet Senator George as well. The fact is that we are going to confront every year new technologies that are going to improve the ability of public safety and law enforcement leaders and officers to address crime, hopefully to solve them more quickly. And that does create a challenge for law enforcement leaders and for legislators that are seeking to make sure that there's a proper balance between our ability to interdict crime and to, at the same time, protect constitutional rights, including the right to privacy. I'll tell you, and I've mentioned this in other meetings, that the issues related to technology and constitutional rights is a front burner discussion among law enforcement leaders. It's not incidental. It's a core discussion right now. And law enforcement is perceived in this context sometimes as ones to be suspicious about. But the reality is that as a part of the charge of law enforcement leadership, protection of constitutional rights is a core function. And it's important to our law enforcement leaders that we are balancing that carefully. It's important because we've taken an oath to protect it. But on top of that, policing effectiveness has to depend on public trust. And in your own communities, with your own law enforcement leaders, we're working all the time to make sure that that trust is preserved. And that means that we're taking these kind of issues seriously. Now, I do want to mention that when we first became aware of this bill, we asked that we have an opportunity to spend a little more time to work through with the ACLU the details of this bill. And we originally suggested that we would like to work with them to move forward with a bill in 2015. It appears that that is not the case, obviously. The bill is before us. But I do want to mention that our posture towards this issue and other issues is that we want to sit down and try to find something that works for the citizens of Oregon. And that is to find that proper balance in everything we're doing. I will mention that there are just a few agencies in the state that really utilize this, but in other states like California, the technology has been used for 15 years. It is a technology that gathers license plates, but the bill suggests in its identification of this technology, the term of art is automatic license plate reader technology, but in the bill it uses the word surveillance to describe this technology. We don't believe this is a surveillance tool in that the plate data that goes into a large database is not connected to LEDs and the LED system. The hits come off of, in the case of Portland Police Bureau, they've created a separate database of specific vehicles that are stolen. And so when the plate data comes in and it's batched, then it runs against those hot lists, and if a plate is identified, there's a ping to that. But LEDs is not accessed, and no personal information is attached to this plate data until there's a specific potential crime that's being investigated. That's the difference between this when it comes to privacy rights. I can understand if this plate data was being batched in large amounts and names and personal identification was associated with it, it would be the kind of thing that could be stolen. And if it was stolen, could put people's privacy rights at risk. But as it is today, it is literally a list of plates. I do want to mention as well that in previous issues of this type, where the concerns about the constitutional rights of our citizens are in place in Oregon, I believe that law enforcement has a really good track record in sitting down and trying to resolve these things. I will mention, and I mentioned in other meetings, and so I apologize for repeating if, for those who heard that in recent years, issues related to the identification of somebody that's responsible potentially for a crime, what we call eyewitness ID, was an issue that came to the legislature as well. And we worked with groups like the OCDLA to sit down and actually put together a policy through a work group that the OCDLA felt like was spot on in terms of making sure that people that are identified in a lineup are properly treated so that there is no chance or a limited chance that the wrong person could be identified. That went so far as to include new training at the Public Safety Academy that we created, as well as a specific training video that was distributed to every law enforcement agency that they could use within their agency training programs. It's our goal to be on top of these issues and to be responsible in partnering. I should mention that the Portland Police Bureau on this very issue, on the issue of license plate reader technologies, worked with the ACLU to develop their automatic license plate reader technology policy. It was worked together with the ACLU, which surprised Portland Police Bureau then when the bill came forward, because they felt they had partnered already in order to try to make sure that the ACLU was comfortable with the parameters and the protections that were put in place in that policy. So I want to mention that our posture on this is partnership, and that's why we've asked for a little more time. I'll briefly talk now about specific pieces of the policy that we have some concerns about. I already mentioned that we don't believe the term surveillance is an accurate word to use to describe this technology and would prefer the term that's used around the nation to describe it, which is automatic license plate reader technology. Ms. Strauss did mention the retention of photographs, which are incidental to these license plate readers. So when the license plate reader dumps all of these license plate numbers in, it identifies the plate. It also can identify the color of the vehicle, which ODOT currently cannot provide to law enforcement through our system, so that in the event that there is a potential crime and a particular license plate is subject to inquiry, they can identify the color, but the capture of actual individuals is incidental. And most of the photos that our law enforcement partners that use this technology indicate that the photo is of the police officer walking in front of their car. So the challenge in the original bill, and I have not had a chance to review the amendments because they were not posted last night when I looked before I came this morning, was that because there are hundreds and thousands of data points here, it's impractical to go through to try to figure out if there are photographs, if there are photographs of people. It would be impossible to remove those. And so that part of the bill simply would not work under its current drafting. The other issue that was mentioned as well in previous testimony has to do with the databases that we would utilize in order to compare plate data in the event that we're trying to solve a crime. It mentions a number of databases. One is the NCIC. That's the national database. That one's really impractical for us to use because, as you can imagine, this technology does not can't decipher between states. So if we run a plate on NCIC, we get plates with similar numbers from states throughout the nation. It's just not a helpful database. Other databases that we do find more helpful are not listed. Some of those were mentioned in earlier testimony, but not all of them. The Portland Police Bureau has a database specifically designed to address hit-and-run incidences. That one's not included, and based on the writing of the bill currently, we would not be able to utilize that. That's one that's been able to identify over 45 hit-and-run vehicles located this last year. Those are hit-and-runs. In some cases, hit-and-runs, in one case, that created serious injury when a parking attendant at the Rose Garden was actually run over by a vehicle. This is the kind of positive side of the technology that hasn't been mentioned so far, but in utilizing this, the databases are important, and we would want to continue to work to identify those databases that really are helpful when we try to compare the data that's captured through these license plate reader technologies and the actual crimes that we're trying to solve. It's already been mentioned, and it is the subject of at least all or most of the amendments, the data retention period. Currently, the data retention periods for the use of automatic license plate readers in the state of Oregon does vary. It varies, I think, in its longest period of time for 10 years, and it goes down from there. We've had as honest a conversation as we can among law enforcement leaders and groups that use these technologies in order to try to come to a retention period that we feel provides the best balance between privacy rights and the ability to capture crimes, not just based on a hit list, but as they're committed and as they evolve. We mentioned to the ACLU that if we had to, and I know this probably makes the sponsors of the bill laugh, we could live with a six-month retention period, but the reality is we believe 1 year is the proper amount to properly balance that. That means we'd be purging all that data every year, and we believe that gives law enforcement the chance not only to identify vehicles that are on hot lists where the vehicle is already stolen, but to address crime situations like the one that happened in Salem a few years ago, where a legislative staffer confronted somebody who had just robbed a bank in downtown Salem. And as he confronted the person that robbed the bank, the perpetrator fired shots at our legislative staffer. That case a license plate reader here in Salem was critical to solving the crime because the person denied, a serial bank robber, denied they were ever in Salem. The license plate reader technology, that particular information, which would not be available under the scenario that's in this bill, was able to identify that the person was actually in Salem at the time.
Kevin, would it be available with the amendments?
I will check to see if the 180-day may. I don't believe the ones previous to that would, but I will check for you. But it is an example of how the technology can be used to actually solve crime. So thank you for that. I will definitely find out for you, and we'll get back to the committee with a specific answer to that because I think it's an important question. But cases like that where you have serial robberies, serial rapists, serial events where the perpetrator continues to be at large, where you may have information but not a suspect, it is the plate data later that may be the most critical or a critical piece in helping to make a case and a prosecution. So I mentioned the retention limit. The third is the court order. That is also addressed in the amendments, evidently, although I haven't seen them. 30-day court appearances to request extension is too often. It's a huge burden on judges, a huge burden on law enforcement. It's quite a process to get the extension. And so I appreciate consideration of an extension. Our preference would be the longer retention time and, if appropriate, a longer period of time to retain the data based on requiring law enforcement to make a case that it's important to do so. And if I understood the -3 or the -4 amendments correctly, it would create the 180-day retention period, but then would eliminate any chance of requesting further retention. We would not be supportive of that. We do believe there needs to be a further retention ability.
Kevin, that's not my understanding of what that amendment would do, but you haven't had a chance to see it.
Yeah, my apologies, that. Senator Shields, and I will get those and review them as soon as I can so that I could take a look at that, because I was just going off of the testimony, and I thought that's what she said, but thank you, because I will revisit that in order to make sure I'm accurate on that. Section 4 deals with the adoption of policies. It really requires two policies to be adopted. One is an automatic license plate reader policy, how the technology is actually going to be utilized. The other is a privacy policy. Those are both important. We have absolutely no problem with requiring that agencies adopt those policies. The bill does require those policies, along with a report regarding the utilization of the technology, to be posted conspicuously, is the word in the bill, on the website. I don't think we have a problem posting information on the website. I don't think there's any real advantage for law enforcement to hide information like that. But as you can imagine, there are a number of important policies, procedures, challenges that law enforcement is facing that they currently believe they need to have available to the public on their website. It could involve other issues that are important to you. It could be information about use of force policies or issues related to concerns about race-based policing or other things. So we're not supportive of the concept of making a posting conspicuous. The word is a little bit strange in itself. I don't know if it's a term of art or it's in, but it does seem to mean front and center. And while we think this is important and we believe that any smart police agency will be in communication with the public about how they're using these technologies, we are concerned that the word conspicuous may create a burden in terms of putting this on a website where it could compete with other legitimate public safety issues that need to be promoted on public websites in law enforcement agencies' efforts to be in communication with their folks. The last one is Section 6. Section 6 is a unique one in that I know that it seeks to allow a citizen to find out what a public body knows about them in terms of their information. The bill, as it's written, allows a person, a registered owner of a vehicle, to access their own data or allow a person who has written permission to access that data. We oppose this provision for a very important reason. There is an exception. The exception is if there is a restraining order. You can imagine if there's a restraining order and a registered owner is trying to find out information of where their car may have been, that there could be a problem there. If there was a restraining order because of abuse or a marital issue that resulted in violence, a restraining order is put in place in order to protect a person. A person requesting that information could be doing so in order to find out information that could escalate or put a person or a protected person at risk. But the reality is, all of you know that not everybody who's at risk, not everybody who's in a domestic dispute, not everyone that is subject to danger within a relationship or within a family structure has a restraining order to protect them. Law enforcement is concerned that if a registered owner of a vehicle can request information about the location of their vehicle, that innocent parties that could be at risk could be put in jeopardy. And so we believe that we understand the heart of this. We believe that it doesn't work, and we believe that it could potentially put people in danger. With that, Mr. Chair, I want to say that I deeply appreciate the respect I've been afforded in being able to oppose a bill that the chair and co-chair are supportive of. We take the privacy rights of citizens very seriously. We believe there is a balance in terms of how to construct a bill that would allow the positive uses of this technology to move forward without putting privacy rights at undue risk. I do share the concerns that many people have about the recent NSA scandal and the kind of incredible surveillance that does occur on the American public. But your local police leaders, those who are working with you locally, are very cognizant and take seriously their responsibility to protect privacy rights and the other constitutional rights of citizens. We hope you'll afford us a chance to move the arrow a little bit on the retention period. At some point, the technology is not worth using in terms of the cost and benefit, and we want to make sure that we are utilizing this to solve crimes that we believe the public has a strong interest in solving. So with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time today. We do hope we'll have a chance to continue to have conversations about this moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Kevin. I appreciate it. It seems like that there were only a couple of new issues that we didn't discuss around the table. One is that the internal, what I assume is an internal database at the Portland Police Bureau relating to hit and runs. That seems to be a new topic, and I know we're moving quickly. And then two, the opposition to people being able to request how the government is using their own data. Is that kind of the summation? The other ones are just kind of policy decisions that we've kind of hammered out, and I understand your opposition. Those are the new ones, right, that need to be addressed?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. And I do want to add, I use the example of the Portland Police Bureau database, but I believe that there are others that local police departments are currently using similar to Portland, and that's why my list is not an extensive list. I've been, every time I come upon a new technology, it's a learning experience for me in trying to find out how different agencies try to manage this in order to, utilize the technology in ways that recover stolen vehicles and to solve these kind of crimes is more complicated, of course, than it always seems. So I just want to make sure that databases that are currently being used, these are databases of plates that are already associated with wanted warrants, stolen cars. These are and they do that. There's another database, by the way, that is a do not stop database that's been created so that we are not stopping because we can't tell sometimes which state a plate is from. We're not stopping people from another state for which the warrant does not apply. It's a protection in order to avoid pulling over a Washington resident with the same license plate as a person in Oregon who's wanted. Those are the kind of databases that law enforcement utilizes in order to actually minimize the impact on innocent individuals. And so I just want to make sure those are captured. But you're correct. Those are the two main issues. The others just represent differences of position.
Right.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, good. And I think, Senator George couldn't make it today, but there were basically two big surveillance or whatever you want to call them, bills. One, an electronic records was more complicated, I think we'd agree, and what we decided to do is to punt that one to kind of an interim committee. I think Senator George felt strongly that this bill wasn't as complicated, that we need to get it in place right away, and then law enforcement can come back in 2015 and say, you know, this is where it's not working, and this is where we need to tweak it. Again, just kind of a difference of opinion of how we should proceed. But I do appreciate you sitting through those meetings and your good nature during sometimes tense negotiations.
Well, so, thank you.
Senator Bairdsugar.
So, you know, every time we get into this new technology and we think how smart we are, I have to chuckle. So, you know, this license plate reading only will work on the premise that people keep the correct license plates on the cars. And it takes 2 minutes to swap these plates around. I have over 20 vehicles. I couldn't tell you if the right plates are on those vehicles or not. Could go years and years and years. So, you
Kevin
know,
can probably tell you.
Yes, Senator, we know where those are.
Yeah. There lies the problem. But anyways, I think that as this technology moves forward, the criminal mind is going to figure it out, and you're going to start seeing lots of different license plates and lots of different cars.
Senator Shields,
then it'll all fall
apart. Senator Bairdsugar, you're correct, and this is obviously not a new technique utilized by those that are committing crimes, and that's why license plate data readers are a piece of evidence, not the controlling piece of evidence that brings a case to conclusion. As you know, those things do happen. I did want to mention, you know, that we are glad that we're in the role where we have to carefully balance privacy rights, constitutional rights, and law enforcement effective tools. We have to balance that. Of course, those who are committing crimes have no such interest, and we understand that. That's one of the downsides, but we do believe this technology has some significant potential to assist and to prevent, reduce victimization and to solve crimes as a part of the equation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next up is Maylee Browning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Shields. Members of the committee, my name is Maylee Browning. I am a third-year law student extern working with Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm excited and honored to testify today in support of SB 1522. First, the OCDLA extends its gratitude to Senator George and Senator Shields and the stakeholders in introducing this bill. We appreciate your attention to this critical issue, and we appreciate your careful thought that you put into crafting this bill. First, I would like to underscore that the HIT data can be retained irrespective of the limitation period in this bill. The limitation period at issue in this bill concerns the retention of non-HIT data. In the course of judicial prosecution, the issue of the retention of non-HIT data will never be addressed. Because the judiciary will not be in the position to address this issue, this is an issue that must be addressed by the legislature. With the rapid advancement of technology these days, it's important to have guidelines set forth which limit the use of this technology, which provides oversight to the public bodies which use this technology, and which ensures the privacy rights of our citizens. The legislature is in the position to get ahead of such technology and create these guidelines, and we support moving forward with SB 1522 this session. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And then I'd like to bring up Becky Strauss to address some of the additional concerns to see if those were thought through in the amendments or if, Becky, you believe that we might need additional amendments to make sure that there aren't unintended consequences.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, again, Becky Strauss on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Thanks for the opportunity to come back up and respond to some of the concerns raised by Kevin Campbell and the law enforcement community more broadly. I'm not sure if we want to tick through each of them. I'll just go ahead and do that.
That's fine, but I think primarily I wanted you to address the, kind of the new issues and whether or not you felt like we needed new amendments or do the current amendments address those, you know, the the requesting of the license plate information in whether or not it might put people at risk, and then to the hit and run kind of internal databases, if you think our current amendment hits that. But actually, I'll just hand it to you, and but feel free not to give your entire testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. The issue of the terminology of the definition concern raised about surveillance being a part of the definition, I think we would just disagree. I think we believe that this is surveillance. This is what this technology is doing. It seems that the argument might also suppose that surveillance cameras aren't surveillance, and that seems counterintuitive to not call surveillance cameras surveillance. And so I think that's going to be a decision up to the committee, but we're inclined to keep that term in there. On the issue of the cameras capturing images of people, I'm happy to work with Kevin. I believe that issue is addressed in the amendments. There may be an issue about capturing the color of the vehicle, and that is valuable. Kevin and I will talk about that. I have to say I'm a little bit concerned because we did have an hour and a half long stakeholder meeting, and I did what I thought my best attempt was to gather all of the concerns raised and incorporate those into the amendments. We now have those amendments, and so I'm trying to work with timelines on new issues that were brought up today. In regard to the databases that may not be an exhaustive list, have no problem with adding the hit-and-run database. I would just make a point that in addition to timelines and amendments, if we can make that work, there's no substantive objection to adding new databases. I think that the issue highlights, again, the urgency of doing this now. It is certainly the ACLU's preference, and I believe in the past it's been expressed as certainly some members of this legislature's preference to operate with clear guidelines on data collection. And then if law enforcement wants to come back and explain and make their case to the legislature about a new reason or a new addition to engage in further surveillance, that's absolutely their prerogative, and we believe that's the chronology of how that process should go. So if we're talking about we have the universe of databases now, let's put them out there, and if there's another new database, I would ask law enforcement interests to come to the legislature and ask permission to expand this technology for that purpose. On the data retention period, we've had a robust discussion about that, the benefits of real-time data and historical data, and it sounds like we may continue that conversation on the length of the data retention period. I believe on the issue of the court order, I think that our amendments do address that, the -4, which I just sent to Kevin, so we'll have a discussion about that, allows for an upfront 180-day retention period and then also a back-end 180-day court order. So it would be the same as all the rest of them. The only difference is that the 180-day -4 draft doesn't have the quote-unquote escape valve for exceptional circumstances.
So Becky, let me make sure I understand. If we go with 21 days and 180 days, can law enforcement then, at the end of the 180 days, come back to the court and say, we've got a reason to hold on to this data longer and renew the 180?
Chair Shields, yes.
Okay, thanks.
The additional issues raised around posting the privacy policies conspicuously on the website, if that's a sticking point, happy to take out the word conspicuously. The idea is that the public has easy access to the information, and there's no objection to removing that word if that's a problem. And then finally, on the issue of the public records, we tried to craft that, as I said, to balance the interests involved. What I will do is follow up quickly as I can today with victim advocates and see if there's some sort of further balance or expansion that we can put in there to address the concern raised by Kevin.
And on that one, the individual can simply make a request to the agency and get it. There's no court involvement, is that correct?
That's right. It would go through the typical public records process.
But they could do that now, right? I mean, if I wanted to send a public records request to the Portland Police Bureau to find out how many pictures of my license plate they have, they would have to honor that at this point, even without that section of the bill?
We would, Chair Shields, members of the committee, we would argue that under current law, it's at best unclear. And so that the intention of the provision is to clarify an uncertainty in public records law. I know anecdotally that there have been requests to the Portland Police Bureau for people's license plate reader data, and that has not been released. It's been the position of the district attorney that it falls under an exception and that they will not release the data.
Really?
We don't believe that it's clear. And so this is meant to clarify that people's personal records, it's hard to balance both of these things, because on the one hand we hear the discussion of law enforcement agencies are not collecting that much, this is just license plates, it's not a big deal, but then on the other hand we hear this is very sensitive information and should be exempt from public record, and we should guard against any person who might want access to it. So I'm having trouble reconciling those things, but the intention of Section 6 and the privacy policy is to say this is very private information. We're acknowledging that location and travel pattern data is very private information about people, and it should not be accessible to the public through a public records process. The exception in Section 6 about accessing one's own data is, again, to allow a little bit of accountability, transparency, and oversight so that individuals, innocent individuals, may have access and know what the government is collecting about them. Again, I am more than happy to shop around that language a little bit more and just make sure that we're not putting forward something that might have an unintended consequence for the safety of someone.
Okay. Okay. Well, I think, you know, we also have a chance in either the General Government Committee on the House side or wherever the Speaker might decide to send this bill to, you know, tweak some of these outstanding questions, but it seems to me that this is doable this session, and I think we need to get ahead of it. Otherwise, we'll be reacting. And I think, you know, while I appreciate the point of view that it's law enforcement's job to balance the civil liberties, I think I would agree with you that it's our job to set the boundaries that law enforcement can aggressively pursue all wrongdoers and law violators. So. All right. Thank you. Anybody else want to testify on this bill? Then we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1522, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1571. Shannon, can you tee it up for us, please?
Certainly. Chair Shields, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1571 comes from Chair Shields. We are waiting for the paperwork on the amendments to this bill, so it is not ready to move today, and we should carry it over until Wednesday. The original version of the measure prohibits a contractor from soliciting restoration work business via in-person contact with the property owner after some sort of disaster or emergency. The proposed -1 amendments replace the measure but deal with the same topic. They include restoration companies within the definition of contractor for the Construction Contractor Board oversight, and they prohibit restoration companies from contracting for work within 1,000 feet and 48 hours of a disaster unless summoned by the occupant, the insurer, or to offer board-up services under agreement with the fire department. It voids the contract if it's formed in violation of the measure and provides a 3-day non-waivable rescission right. The proposed -2 amendments also replace the measure, and they provide the contracting person with a 5-day right to rescind a contract for restoration work after it is made.
Okay, so that's the description of the -1.
Ones and -2s.
And -2. So essentially what we have, and correct me if I'm wrong, is kind of a more complicated regulatory structure for the -1s. And then -2 just includes the right to rescind that is non-waivable.
Correct.
Is that correct? For up to 5 days?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The rescission right is waivable if the contractor provides a written good faith estimate of the cost of services. But if that written estimate of cost of services is not provided, the rescission right is non-waivable.
Okay.
We have a person who would like to testify via phone.
Okay.
Would you like me to call for now?
Yes, let's start with Teresa.
Thank you. So we'll come back to her.
Or try again. Mm-hmm. It looks like we got disconnected.
Let's try one more time.
Teresa, hi. This is Chip Shields. You are live at the Senate General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee.
Hi, Senator. Thanks so much for allowing me to testify via phone today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I realize that there are some challenges with transportation in the state for the last couple of days. So we've just introduced the bill. We've just introduced the two amendments. So why don't we start? You can give us some context by telling your testimony. So please proceed when you're ready.
Okay. My name is Teresa DeHanger. I'm represented by Senator Rosenbaum in District 21 and House District 42 under Senator Bailey. I used to live in Senator Shields' district, the Northeast. So I'll briefly share the same story that I shared in January, which led to the development of this bill. I lost everything I owned in a five-alarm fire on MLK and Monroe on August 8th. A few hours after the fire, the scene was still smoldering. People lined up across the street from the house and approached me about recovering my belongings, which, as you can imagine, were pretty unrecoverable after, I think, 135 million gallons of water were poured into the fire. These folks worked for restoration companies that were called to the scene. In the end, I was charged over $3,000 for services that were not necessary, and they had never given me an estimation or a contract specifying any amount of money. The contract was basically a blank check. And, you know, I'm usually a smarter person than this. I feel like I'm highly capable, and I'm just, I was a victim of a very violent crime, and a few hours after, I feel like I was really taken advantage of at my most vulnerable moment. So my point being, restoration companies that ambulance chase victimize the vulnerable. I asked to speak again today because I don't want the human voice to get lost in this. Protections are needed to help victims of disasters from predatory practices. I think, moreover, that Dash 1 amendment is necessary.
Okay.
And that's all I'd like to say today.
Great.
Thank you so much for hearing me, Senators. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to discuss this really important bill.
Great. Thank you, Teresa, for coming forward and telling your story. We have no questions on the panel for you, and we appreciate you coming back and making time for us a second time. So we'll let you hang up and get back to your day.
Okay. Thanks so much, Senator.
Thanks. Uh-huh. All right. Can we bring up John Knorr and Pam Smith, please? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Senator Shields and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is John Knorr, and I'm here representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. Fires are a very traumatic time for the victim, and I truly call them a victim because they experience something that very few people really experience in their lifetime. And if I were to look around the room and say, anybody that's lost all their possessions in a structure fire, raise your hand, there probably wouldn't be many people in the room that would raise their hand. But the reality is it happens to several hundred people a year across Oregon. People are very much in a time of need at that point. They're watching their possessions burn up. They watch the firefighters on the scene dealing with the issue. And my experience in my jurisdiction is they're being approached sometimes aggressively by people actively trying to get them to hire them as the restoration and cleanup of folks for their fire. And I really feel that people are vulnerable at that point. I've taken it to the point where I have assigned a firefighter to stand with a homeowner and not let them be solicited at that time because of the aggressiveness of some of the folks that are soliciting them. I could much rather use that firefighter on the scene for fire suppression efforts than to have to protect the homeowner, but I really felt that that was the need at that point. This is fairly recent in my jurisdiction. I've only seen it probably in about the last 5 years where people are actively approaching the scene, seeking out homeowners, initiating conversation with them, and for lack of a better word, taking them down a path of selling them some goods. I'm not sure what they're selling, but what I do know is that the people at that point oftentimes appear to be not to be in a good place for making those decisions at that time. So I want to thank you for bringing it forward. I also want to thank you for providing Oregon Fire Chiefs Association with the opportunity to ask for an amendment that would allow us to, in the jurisdictions that choose to have a process in place to allow board-up companies to participate in a process and actually be on a call list. And Senator Pazansky sat in on a work group last week, and he was very astute in noticing that there are really two keys here. There is the board up or the immediate securing of the property, and then there's the restoration work. It's starting at some point thereafter, stopping forward damage and starting to recover and replace and repair. And so for us as a fire service, it's important for us to be able to secure the property once we leave the scene, so that there's no further damage from someone breaking in and taking or potentially taking whatever's left or water leaking in or things of that nature. So it is really kind of two different issues. The fire service appreciates the opportunity to have a process in place to allow board-up companies to come to the scene.
Okay. And, John, has the association been able to look at both of the amendments?
Yeah. I am familiar with Dash 1. I'm not as familiar with Dash 2.
Okay. Good. Well, we'll probably wrestle with which one to go forward with. My sense is that we're likely to go with the Dash 2 at this point just because we think we need a broader discussion for 2015, but we can get the Dash 2 in place and then continue to monitor it. So if you all wouldn't mind taking a look at the Dash 2 and make sure that there are no unintended consequences there as well.
I will.
But, Chana, if you could, your impression is that the Dash 2 also addresses the board-up issue?
Just Chair Shields, members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendments define board-up services and then specify that restoration work does not include board-up services.
Thank you.
And we appreciate your work on this, Jen, and all that you do in Portland. Thanks. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. Thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Pam Smith, and I work for Portland Construction Solutions. We are one of the restoration companies out in the industry. We are for the bill, 1571. We do not ever fire chase. We do not condone the other companies that fire chase. My history is I've been with the restoration industry for 3 years, and I was an insurance agent prior to that for 23. And I have to say, in those 23 years of being an insurance agent, never did I ever have a client fire chased, as we're calling it. And I think it's changed in the last, after we had our meeting a couple weeks ago, I think it's changed in the last 4 years. Someone once told me personally that he brought fire chasing to Oregon and was proud of it. Don't understand that, because we also look at, we call them victims as well, but, you know, it could be a homeowner, it could be an apartment owner, but they are watching their largest asset go up in flames or from a large water loss. And these companies are out there listening to scanners. There are some places that they can pay to get emails from dispatch, is what I've been told. I don't know if that's the exact truth, but I did work for a company that would get those emails and I would see them, so I'm not sure what service is providing that. I know ServPro was named in that article, but unfortunately they're only one of several, so, you know, just to isolate them, probably not fair, but unfortunately the other companies have had to change how they do practices out there because they have hurt restoration companies that are out there doing it the right way. We're out there building relationships with the insurance agents, the insurance adjusters, property managers. We go out when we're called. We will never show up on scene unless we're invited. So He made a good point one time about he's had to assign someone next to a homeowner, but unfortunately, when the fire department is done, they have to leave, and you may have three or four companies out there waiting to go talk to that homeowner. So we support the buffer zone of the 1,000 feet for 48 hours. We feel that that homeowner has the right to not be preyed upon, stalked, and I have witnessed those companies going out there and trying to get the homeowner to sign a contract, and for all intents and purposes, they're closing a deal. They're not building relationships. They're just out there chasing one fire after the next to get the business. And they do prey upon their time and need. Like Teresa said on the phone, she believes herself to be very bright. But at that time of need, you've got a company stepping up saying, we will do whatever it takes to take care of you. You want to believe them. You want to take care of your house, your belongings, so you go with them and you hire them. So we support the 1,000 feet buffer zone for 48 hours. We also support the dash 1 and dash 2. There were, I'm a little confused with the 3-day and the 5-day, but we do believe they should have a right to rescind. The only thing that we probably have a problem with is if a company comes in, let's say on the third day, and they have a contract and they get it signed and they do it right, we're hesitant on that 3 to 5 day because we're doing it the right way. What we feel strongly with is if that contract is signed in the first 48 hours, that's when your time should be the 3 or 5 days to rescind. We look at the board up services as something completely different. Then you've got step two, which is the mitigation part of protecting the property, starting to clean things, and then the final step of everything is putting it back together. And we support almost everything in the bill. We just have a few concerns on the rights to rescind. The other thing that we were concerned with was the good faith estimate. At the very first start of a loss, you don't necessarily know what those estimates are going to be. You get into the home and you start the process of, for an example, if you need to dry things out, you're setting up equipment, you're doing some flood cuts into walls to start the air movement going up in there. So you really have no idea until everything is dried out what extent of damages you have based on square feet, based on the number of equipment you have there. We go back on a daily basis and check the moisture readings if it's a water loss. So it's almost impossible to know at day one of a loss what the estimate would be. So that's one thing that we have a concern with in the bill. So, and really just to kind of interrupt, we really do support the bill in the way it sits, just a few minor concerns that we have, but we definitely feel that the general public needs to be aware of this. Those in our industry are aware of the ones that are fire chasing. Unfortunately, the public is not, so hopefully this will bring light to that.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Teresa, I know that you know you're not a professional lobbyist, and probably looking at amendments is kind of a foreign task. But to get the right to rescind correct, is there a word you'd take out or a word you'd add, or do you have some thoughts or on how
probably,
we can proceed there?
Probably not the best thoughts. I was trying to get the owner of our company or the operations manager to come down, but they did not due to the weather and the losses we received over the weekend. They're at the office.
Right.
They would talk to you if you need to talk to them. Our biggest concern is going in, doing it the correct way, and then if you were to have this other company that's shady come in and convince the homeowner you don't want to go with them and give them lies and get them to rescind. So our issue is, if you're doing it the right way, that right to rescind could hurt the companies out there that maybe are being lied about by those others.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I just don't know if there's a way to resolve it. You just have to be more persuasive than the others. But your point I appreciate it. We'll see what we can do to come up with. We can also work on this on the House side, so it's got to go through two chambers and two committees where it could be potentially amended. But this is all very good feedback, so thanks. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good testimony. Let's bring up Stan Jessup from the CCB.
Senator Shields and members of the committee, Craig Smith is my name. I'm here with Stan Jessup, with your permission. This morning was a little bit difficult, and we appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. We have some written materials. I presume you have that in front of you. The agency, of course, is neutral on the bill. The board has not had a chance to look at it, and we've been working, though, with the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to do that. And we're here to talk a little bit about what the I should tell you that Stan's our budget guy, and he's been working on this bill, helping us out. He'll probably see him more in the future. So he's here assisting. You know what the problem is? The proposed solution is to broaden the definition of a contractor. It will include cleaning people, for purposes of defining a contractor. Then there will be a variety of additional requirements that restoration contractors have to do. There could be some concerns that the agency will have to deal with as the if this bill, the dash one, is what we're looking at right now, goes through as written. They include additional licensing requirement reaching out to those folks that are in the cleaning industry only, some different contract requirements that we'll have to train on. The enhanced penalties are not a problem, but they could require some more hearings, a few more hearings, because of the additional pressure on the perpetrator of the bad act. There'll be some resources that we'll have to reallocate. And then, of course, there's a little bit of a conflict that the policy analyst noted in this bill that, frankly, I'm not prepared to talk about, but we have it in writing. So that's an overview of what the bill would do, what our concerns are, and we're here to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. So you haven't come up with a fiscal impact for LFO yet on what the dash one is, but you think basically there will be one, and that does make sense that there would be more work and fees associated with this.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, we'll give that some thought. I'm not sure what the level of fiscal impact might be, but this is relatively a small amount of work. We have a robust staff at your disposal, and we'll have to think about whether or not this actually adds anything more than a minimal.
Okay. All right, good. Any questions? All right, thank you very much. Amanda, sure. Did you want to come up and address anything around the rescission, or do you think we've got the issues? Okay, please come up to the dais. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for all your work on this as well as the previous bill.
Yeah. Hi, for the record, my name is Amanda Hess, and I'm the legislative aide to State Senator Chip Shields. And I don't want to take up too much of your time, but just for the record. After we met in January to do an informational hearing on this bill, there was a couple concerns raised. We did a work group which included the League of Oregon Cities, the counties, the fire chiefs, the fire associations, the CCB, and a couple of restoration companies. You've heard from Portland Construction Services, but also on the phone was Kennedy Restoration. And I've talked to a number of restoration companies who have contacted us personally after seeing a COIN article on the subject. The restoration companies that have contacted our office have been very supportive of the bill. As you've heard from testimony, they've seen a real cut to restoration businesses that work through insurance companies and through word of mouth, through relationships in the communities. They've seen a real cut in their business in the last 4 years from this fire chasing tactic. In Eugene, a fire association down there also informed us that the number of restoration companies on site has more than tripled from about one or two to upwards of 9 or 10. And in work group, we had discussed how these companies actually have gotten into fisticuffs over getting customers. And the tactic really is to get in there and make sure you get the blank check contract signed. And also to iterate that a lot of shady tactics had been anecdotally given to us about what folks say when they get to, you know, we've been called by your insurance adjuster, what's your insurance adjuster's name, oh, what we forgot, things like that in order to get to the victim of the disaster. You have two amendments before you. The first amendment expands what the Construction Contractors Board work currently undertakes, but not necessarily what their statutory authority already has. So the definition of a construction or of a contractor is fairly broad, includes the word to restore. I believe we can call up Chuck Taylor if you have any specific questions about the details of the amendments. But it clarifies that we found that restoration companies that just do cleaning service and have agreements, not necessarily formal general contracting, subcontracting agreements, but relationships with construction contractors will get the blank check contract and just do the cleaning services, so they don't have to get CCB licensure. So the first, the Dash 1 Amendment, and before you put this on, the Dash 1 Amendment clarifies that restoration companies would be licensed through the CCB. We found that those good acting restoration companies are already licensed through the CCB. Secondly, in order to have a CCB license, there's a threshold for $2,000. If you expect to charge a person $2,000, that you have to have a written contract. This gives the CCB authority to do the same thing for these restoration contracts, but also states that the contract must have a cost estimate or rate for service. We think this is just common sense practice that maybe everyone who signs a contract should know how much their blank check is being written for. And it prohibits solicitation within 1,000 feet of the disaster within 48 hours. This does not include when they're called to the scene by the consumer or the consumer's insurance company, and it doesn't include board-up services if they have an agreement with a government entity. And it lastly gives a 3-day right to rescind, similar to the there's already a right to rescind under home sales law. However, that home sales law is a waivable right, so a good acting or a restoration company that's acting within the law right now will say that, yeah, but in order to actually restore your items right away, we need you to waive your right. So this makes it a non-waivable right. The Second Amendment that we had, the Dash 2 amendments, focused just on the right to rescind. And it would be a 5-day right to rescind. The reason that we made it longer is that, unlike sales where you're getting a vacuum cleaner sold at your house, you see the product, you can think about the next day how your wife didn't want the product. Looking at you, Bob. But in these instances, you have to have a conversation, usually with your insurance company, about what's covered, and that isn't necessarily figured out day one, or nor to the extent of the cost. And up to Pam's point, the contract becomes... Okay, so for the 5-day right to rescind, it's only waivable if you give a good faith estimate of the total cost. That means that you have a number of days, those 5 days, in order to give that good faith estimate. You don't have to give it at the contract right, but in order to waive that, you have to have a good faith estimate. And I think that, again, common sense about what you're signing in legal agreements. And if the actual price goes over the cost...
Just a question on that, because that was the one piece that I was concerned about, especially when you have... a home completely destroyed, and
I certainly wouldn't be able to remember all of the things. They might come up later that, oh, yes, my whatever, my stereo or this or something or my coin collection or something. I don't know what is even covered in restoration. But a good faith means a good faith. But if it goes to another $1,000, no, this is just restoration of the physical facility, correct?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I just need to understand a little bit more about what flexibility the restoration company has in if they give a good faith estimate, but then they find out that it's more because of plumbing issues or because of the type of flooring there was, et cetera. Will that there be leeway there then?
Yeah, basically what it says is that if you go over that good faith estimate, that you have to sign into another contract for those services.
Okay.
And what that means is that it basically puts onus on the restoration company to be a good communicator with the person that they signed a legal agreement with. And that they keep tally on how much, I mean, be pretty clear on how much they're charging the person.
Well, in any contract, there are overcharges sometimes, so, yeah.
That's right. It would be like a work order, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, Jenna, could you, as an attorney, tell us that about the writers, and then once would that start the clock ticking again at the 5 days once they signed a new contract?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, what I read in Section 4 says that if it goes over the cost estimate, the cost of repairs go over the cost estimate, the restoration company is required to give a new and amended contract to the person that they're contracting with. And if they do that, then the time starts over on the right to rescind.
Okay.
So it's subject to the earlier provisions of it. If they don't give the written estimate, then the right to rescind does not expire. So that same leeway that is available at the start of the formation of the contract is available when the clock starts over with each new version.
Okay.
So my guess is that the dash 2 addresses some of the current concerns that were brought up by our testifier.
Pam.
Pam, yes, thank you. I was looking at the sheet. I would like, Pam, if you could take a look at that and see if we have some suggestions. We're going to have to move this out of committee on Wednesday, so we're not going to have a whole lot of time, but we can still, I can go over and testify in front of the other committee on the House about what we think the suggestions should be. I think it gets to the spirit of what you would like to have happen, Pam, without setting a big regulatory structure, which my vice chair had some concerns about, and let's keep working on it. But thank you very much for coming down to testify, Amanda. Great work on it. Bob, you've had a chance to review the amendments. Do you want to put anything on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. 2 points to put on the record is one, I think it's important that as this bill moves through the process, that one emphasize and reiterate that this is not a problem that's unique to the Portland metropolitan area. As I was involved in this, we certainly reached out to firefighters throughout the state, and lo and behold, as noted by your more than capable staff, there's problems in Eugene, there's been problems in Salem and throughout the state. And so I think that's important for the legislative body to know that. Second point that I would make is this is a point, a step in the right direction. We're appreciative of the fact that some of these restoration companies, I want to emphasize, they do good work, and it's an important work. I think not only are there good players out there, unfortunately there's bad players, and these fire victims, if you will, are really vulnerable. And so in the dash 2 amendments, certainly if we need to do this maybe over in the House, I think one component that would be important is not just having written notification position of that, because at the time when you have something like a fire that affects you, I can tell, just like Chief Nord does from my own experience, while these people may be listening to you or signing lots of documents, it's really hard. So if in that communications, as noted, it forcing the industry to be good communicators is important, and even potentially, and I apologize, I wasn't at the work group, basically when they are explaining that initial contract to them, not just having it in the written documentation, but verbally communicating that to that individual may make the difference to recognize that, oh, I made a mistake. So whether that's already in place, I don't know. I would defer to the committee administrator on that. But final point that I make is just kudos to the person sitting to my left. She's done great work on this bill. We're appreciative and supportive of it and are here to help you, Mr. Chair, and anyone else to move this bill through the process.
Great.
Senator Moss, Mr. Chair, I am concerned about the fact that it would possibly go to Ways and Means, and it would be awesome if we could have some kind of amendment that at least sort of addresses the issue in case it doesn't go to Ways and Means. That would be the only reason.
Well, my guess is that the Dash 1 may end up at Ways and Means, but the Dash 2, I can't imagine, would have any fiscal impact. Okay. Great. All right. Thanks. Anything else, Chair? We are carrying over work sessions to Wednesday, February 12th, for Senate Bill 1522 and Senate Bill 1571, and this meeting is adjourned.